From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we are very thankful for that and for each one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar for this week, June 7th is the Orthodox Christian Feast of Corpus Christi. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief show.
The United States is the single largest supporter of family planning and reproductive health programs overseas. Yet, due to incorrect implementation of the Helms Amendment, adopted in 1973, women are being denied safe abortion care, even if they have been raped or their pregnancy endangers their life.
The Helms Amendment was born in the wake of Roe v. Wade in 1973 and blocks foreign aid funding of abortion as a means of family planning. Tragically, the amendment has been widely misapplied, depriving countless women around the world who have been sexually victimized of crucially needed care. A coalition of faith and secular organizations has been hard at work to change that. And on this week's show, I'll talk about that work with the Reverend Harry Knox, President and CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice.
An overwhelming victory for Samantha Eloff. The Supreme Court on Monday ruled in favor of Eloff in an 8-1 vote for a suit against the Abercrombie & Fitch Co. clothing store.
On Monday of this last week, the Supreme Court handed down its ruling in EEOC versus Abercrombie & Fitch, an important test of the right to religious expression at work. Competing interests are claiming the decision, which involves the right of a young Muslim woman to wear religious garb at work, as a victory for their vision of religious liberty. Later in the show, I've got some thoughts to share as to why this isn't Hobby Lobby 2, despite attempts on the religious right to spin it that way. But first,
corporate leaders push back with a massive campaign of public relations. The most trusted people in America are ministers. And so if we can get ministers to make this case for us, it'll resonate with the public. And that's exactly what they do.
We've spent a great deal of time in the past few weeks examining America's changing religious landscape from a number of perspectives. Using the recent Pew poll showing continued growth in the number of religiously unaffiliated Americans as our springboard, we've talked about what these changes mean for churches, culture, and government. This week, I want to look at an even bigger picture, where much of that religiosity came from in the first place. And the inspiration for doing that is a remarkable new book titled One Nation Under God, a meticulously researched and annotated history of the conscious, deliberate campaign to reimagine an America dedicated to a Christian supreme being. It's the work of Dr. Kevin Cruz of Princeton University, and I am pleased now to have the author joining us. Kevin, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you start, please, by describing the most important facts that you're presenting in this book?
I think the broad strokes would be, one, many of the things that we take for granted when we think about America as being either a Christian nation or just a religious nation in general are, in fact, a fairly recent creation. They don't come to us from the founders. They come from perhaps the generation of our grandparents or our parents. So things like phrases like One Nation Under God or In God We Trust, traditions like the National Day of Prayer or the National Prayer Breakfast and so on. A lot of the religious slogans and ceremonies that inflect our national politics and our government, these are creations of really the 1950s. And the second takeaway point I would like to make would be that the story that I had traditionally heard about when these things had been created was one that really put them in the framework of the Cold War, that America, in the midst of fighting the godless communists of the Soviet Union, that was when and why we embraced all these religious slogans in our national politics. But what I found in the book is that the story actually goes back a little bit further, and it's really, if we're looking at the motivation of the men in the movement who created these trappings of religious nationalism, they were really concerned not about foreign politics in the 1950s, but domestic politics in the 1930s. They were worried not about the Soviet Union. They were fighting the New Deal.
Kevin, I know you're a historian. When you committed yourself to writing this book, how much did you know about what it was eventually going to turn into?
That's a great question. I honestly stumbled my way into it. The book I wound up writing is one I didn't even know was possible. When I started writing this, it was going to be a grassroots study of about a dozen communities that wound up making up the moral majority. And I was going to look at them at the local level in the 60s and the 70s to see, you know, what happened. It's kind of a prehistory of the moral majority. What was going on at the grassroots in the lives of ordinary religious conservatives? But as I started to research that, one of the first places I went, because the story I thought was going to begin with the fight over school prayer, I went to the papers of several Supreme Court justices. And in the papers of Justice Hugo Black, who wrote the 1962 decision Engle v. Vitale, which struck down state-mandated programs of school prayer. In his papers, I found 10 giant boxes filled with angry letters that had been sent into Justice Black. And I was struck that hundreds, if not thousands, of these letters invoked phrases like "one nation under God" and "in God we trust" to tell Hugo Black that he had misread the First Amendment, that he was wrong on separation of church and state, because, you know, over and over again they said, well, isn't our motto "in God we trust"? Doesn't our Pledge of Allegiance say we're one nation under God? On and on. I'd always been told that those things didn't matter. Legal scholars, historians too, have used a term to describe them called ceremonial deism. It's a term that actually gets created right after that decision by a Yale Law School dean, Eugene Rostow. And what they meant by that was deism, the God in these national religious slogans and ceremonies, is always broadly drawn. You know, it's never a reference to Jesus Christ. It's always God or the Almighty. But the ceremonial part was the really important part, because what Rostow meant by that was that they were merely ornamental, that they didn't have any substance to them. They didn't matter. Well, what I found in those letters in Hugo Black's papers was that they really did matter. It's ordinary Americans, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance, the national motto, they meant as much, if not more, than the text of the First Amendment. So suddenly I realized I had an entirely different thread to pull on here. This surprised me. And as an historian, when you get surprised in the archives, that's when you know you're onto something. So I started to pull on that string, and it took me back into the 50s. And I thought, okay, well, now I'm going to tell a story about the creation of all this material, because I was struck by how much happened in the 50s in a relatively short span of time. And God We Trust gets placed on a stamp in 54, paper money in 55, becomes the national motto in 56. Under God gets added to the pledge in 54. In these same years, you have the National Day of Prayer, the National Prayer Breakfast, on and on. So I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell the story of that. But again, I thought I had a handle on that. And as I started to dig into it, I realized, again, that story that I'd been told, that I started to talk about earlier, that this all was a Cold War story, I came to realize that was wrong. So surprised again. So I had another set of strings to follow, and it took me back into the story in the New Deal. So it was a process of about 5 years of digging into the archives, being surprised, digging some more, being surprised again. And only about 5 years into this process did I realize what the book was going to finally look like. I had no idea when I started, but I had to follow my sources, and this is where they took me.
Well, that had to be exciting in itself. We know, as you've already mentioned, that the religious right was doing what they were doing and still are very intentionally, strategically even. Is what you found happening in the 50s and before, was that all equally intentional, or did it just develop? You know, I always thought that a lot of what we were hearing in the 50s was a counter assault on communism. But when I read your book and listen to you, I get the idea there was more involved than that.
It was more involved than that. But in a way, it is still that assault on communism. The problem is that it wasn't just that they saw communism coming from the Soviet Union. They thought communism had already taken root here in America. They constantly denounced the New Deal state as a form of creeping socialism. It's a slippery slope in their minds between what Franklin Roosevelt is doing in the 1930s and what Stalin is doing in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. It's really on a continuum with them. So they use this language about attacking communism or creeping socialism. But if you look behind the scenes in their letters, they're quite intentional about this, that what they have in mind is the New Deal first and foremost.
I see. Well, you begin with what you call the consecration of President Eisenhower. Talk about what that means.
Well, this is one of the things that struck me when I was digging into the 50s, is just how much of Eisenhower's early time in office is really spent breathing this religious revival to life. You know, we talk about Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days with the New Deal. If you look at Eisenhower's first 100 days, Roosevelt was focused on the economy. Eisenhower focused on spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, from his campaign, honestly, you know, he's got Billy Graham feeding them lines of scripture on the campaign trail. He talks about the 1952 race is going to be a great crusade for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't use that term lightly. And once he's elected, he says to Graham, you know, I believe I was elected to lead this country on a spiritual renewal. Mm-hmm. And so he tries to do that from the very start. So the inauguration is, I think, as I say in the book, much more than a political ceremony, it's a religious consecration. The very first float in the inaugural parade is one that's dedicated to the principles of freedom of religion and a God we trust. The very start of the inaugural, Eisenhower that morning has a massive public ceremony, St. John's Episcopal in D.C. 150 guests come with him. The church is packed. They've announced it ahead of time. 800 people waiting outside in the morning chill for this religious ceremony. And the inauguration itself was a religious ceremony in many ways. Eisenhower wrote a prayer that morning. And the very first words he gives his president are this prayer. He invokes, you know, God's blessing on the administration.
Mm-hmm.
So from the very start and on through the early weeks and months of his administration, this is very much something at the forefront of his mind about using this new national religion to try to bring Americans together.
Kevin, my sense is that Eisenhower's spirituality was more general in nature than, say, Bush and Obama talking specifically about Jesus and redemption and so forth. I remember that quote, not exactly from Eisenhower, where he said, everybody ought to believe in God, whatever kind of God that is.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a more general spirituality then, or was he just using language that people would interpret as Christian?
It's a very general spirituality with Eisenhower. You know, he didn't belong to a particular faith until after he was inaugurated.
Mm-hmm.
February 1st, 1953, he's the only president to ever be baptized while in office.
Mm-hmm.
And the faith he chooses, he picks Presbyterianism almost offhandedly, but he does so because his wife, Mamie, is a Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
His entire life, he'd kind of, you know, bounced around from one faith to another. His grandfather was a minister in the River Brethren. His mother had been a Jehovah's Witness. He always kind of vaguely, you know, believed in a fundamentalist type of religion. That's how he described his Christianity, but never really belonged to a specific denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Eisenhower carries that kind of vague approach to religion into office. And he gives that famous line you noted in December 1952, where he says, "Our system of government makes no sense unless it's founded on a deeply felt religious faith,
mm-hmm.
and I don't care what that is."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
Eisenhower's critics mock him for that. William Lee Miller at Yale University says, "Well, apparently the president is a very fervent believer in a very vague religion." that he's keeping freedom as lightly. But Eisenhower, I think that was his exact point. He knew that you had to draw religion broadly in that way in order to welcome in all types of Americans. Americans have been divided by the faith before, Protestants against Catholics, Christians against Jews, to say nothing of minority religions like Buddhism or the Muslim faith, which is starting to come on people's minds at this time. He knew that if you were going to bring Americans together around this religion, it had to be vaguely drawn. It had to be that kind of, again, ceremonial deism that Rostow talked about.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be one that would welcome in Protestants and Catholics and Jews together. So I think he's very intentional about that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, whenever the press played up, you know, that he was a Presbyterian, he got angry. You know, he didn't want his baptism to be publicized in the press. He got incredibly angry when the minister leaked word about it. His broad ecumenical church service on the inauguration, yes, the press should play that up. But the fact that Eisenhower is now a Presbyterian, he did not want that stressed. He wanted a broad religion out there, again, because he thought it could unite people.
Hmm. There are other, obviously, seminal turning points in this history that you have written. Would you highlight two or three of the others?
maybe one before and one after Eisenhower, because Eisenhower really just kind of the pivot point of this story. Mm-hmm. Before him, I tell a story about the ways in which a group of conservative businessmen and sympathetic clergymen advance a language of what they call freedom under God. Mm-hmm. This is really the origin of a lot of the language that takes root in the 50s. But they do so under an ideology of Christian libertarianism. And again, they're targeting the New Deal. Mm-hmm. So this movement really peaks, and it's got ministers. Your listeners have surely heard of them, from Billy Graham, mm-hmm. Abraham Verde, but also James Fifield, a Congregationalist minister from L.A. Mm-hmm. And they all work to advance this new sort of religious language that targets the New Deal. And a story I like in the book, this freedom under God ideology, peaks again the year before Eisenhower is elected with a series of 4th of July ceremonies around this theme. And it's a massive coast-to-coast campaign. They've got ministers competing in sermon contests. They have a national radio program organized by Cecil B. DeMille with Jimmy Stewart as the master of ceremonies, and Lionel Barrymore and Gloria Swanson give speeches. So it's this major national event where they get this language out to the public. And a later one, maybe this, I'm drawn to the way in which Nixon tries to follow Eisenhower's example. Eisenhower was very successful at using this religious language, again, I think, to bring Americans together. Nixon is clumsier with it. He uses it to advance his own agenda. So he holds church services inside the White House,
yes,
with Billy Graham leading several of them, but other hand-picked ministers and hand-picked congregations there to hear them. And also he uses Graham to soften criticism of his war in Vietnam, both through a giant rally at the University of Tennessee after the invasion of Cambodia, and then a massive, to come full circle, a massive 4th of July ceremony in 1970 called Honor America Day, which is, again, it's a rally for the silent majority. So in Nixon's hands, this language of one nation under God that had brought people together in the 50s only winds up driving them apart, because he makes this language something that it becomes an identifier solely of the right. Mm-hmm. And so conservatives rally around it in support of the war, in support of the silent majority. And liberals recoil from it. They retreat from this language that once brought them together.
My guest is Dr. Kevin Crews, author of the important new book, One Nation Under God. Kevin, was there a particularly deceptive moment in this history that we should know about?
I think you can look back to that Freedom Under God campaign in 1951, because it gets set up as we're just trying to breathe a religious emphasis back into the celebration of the 4th of July. Let's remember that religious principles were part of us from the founding, and let's celebrate that. That's how they pitched it. Mm-hmm. Behind the scenes, though, they're very clear that this language is not to celebrate the American past, but rather the change of the American future. Hmm. In fact, their ads make this very clear. Their ads run by these utility companies that support this, utility companies that have been fighting the New Deal for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, well, let's make a Declaration of Independence now, in 1951. Mm-hmm. Declare your independence from the federal government. Declare that the government owes you no security, owes you no survival. You should be independent from that. Mm-hmm. Cast off this oppressor, just as our forefathers cast off the British crown. So in a way, if you look closely at it, it's very clear, and again, behind the scenes, they're very obvious about this, but even from those ads, it's very clear that what they're doing was not quite what they said it was.
Yeah. What motivated this campaign?
Well, in some ways, the idea that America is a Christian nation is one that goes back to just after the founding generation. So it had been around for a while. This particular application, though, this invocation of that language of freedom under God, mm-hmm. Is one that's used to discredit the New Deal. That's their goal. And they had come to this religious language because their first try at rolling back the New Deal had failed horribly. So big business in the early days of the 1930s is publicly discredited. They're blamed for the Great Crash. The New Deal has started, and with it, it is regulating their businesses strongly for the first time. Most problematically for them, it has empowered labor unions really for the first time. So these businesses are catching it from above, from the government, and below, from their own work. Both are kind of pushing back against their authority. So they launch these economic arguments about the merits of free enterprise, and they pour millions of dollars into this. The National Association of Manufacturers, for instance, increases its PR budget 22 times over between 1934 and 1937. They are pouring money at this. The problem is no one's listening because these naked appeals, praising free enterprise, it doesn't work to a country that's still been rocked by the Great Depression, clawing its way out of the rubble. And it comes off as self-serving. There's one of these groups I talk about called the American Liberty League, which is funded heavily by General Motors and DuPont. Well, everyone knows it's funded by General Motors and DuPont. They dismiss it accordingly. Jim Farley, the head of the Democratic Party, says, well, they ought to call the American Liberty League the American Cellophane League. Because, number one, everyone knows it's a DuPont product. And number two, you can see right through it. So they quickly decide that this appeal to free enterprise on its own terms isn't working. So what? How can we pitch business, they say? Well, who are the most trusted people in America? Well, polls show the most trusted people in America right now are ministers. So let's get ministers to make this argument for us. And that's where this language about freedom under God comes about.
So there was an economic motive that was being pushed to people who were thinking more about the language of the movement and thinking more about that as an affirmation of their religion rather than an affirmation of one kind of economy.
That's right. What they do is they link capitalism and Christianity.
Yeah.
And they link them together by saying it's a simplistic version of Christianity, but Christianity, you rise and fall on your own merits.
Mm-hmm.
The good go to heaven, the bad go to hell.
Yeah.
In capitalism, you rise and fall on your own merits. The good make a profit, the bad go to the poorhouse. And they say, well, any system that interferes with that divinely prescribed order of things is corrupt. In fact, it is pagan statism.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they tell ministers and they tell the congregations of these ministers and through them that this New Deal isn't just restricting the rights of businessmen. If it's doing that, it's restricting the rights of individuals across the board, and that also then restricts religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So they made the New Deal not just what conservatives have seen as a threat to their economic liberty, they made it into a menace to religious liberty as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that motivates people who wouldn't have cared one way or another about what happens to General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to happen to, say, the Methodist Church, now we care.
So who got hurt the most by this Christianization of history methodology?
In some ways, religious liberals do.
Mm-hmm.
At first, they don't quite mind this. You know, they're celebrating a general return to religion. There's a religious revival that I think this fuels in the 1950s. They're happy about that. But then this religious language quickly becomes co-opted by the right, and they find themselves marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
They don't quite have either the political power from the 50s on, and most importantly, the financial backing that the right has in using this language. And so what you get is a movement that really uses this religious language, ironically, to trump the social gospel, to really sideline any idea that there's a liberal version of religion that manifests itself in our politics. Now, others would use this language to advance liberalism. You know, I think Martin Luther King does this quite well.
Mm-hmm.
He uses this language about, you know, one nation under God to advance the cause of civil rights. But on the economic side, I think it really falls away. I think they might be the big losers here.
Yeah. Do you see these same principles and campaigns influencing our culture and politics today?
I think they do. They've largely been divorced from their economic origin. This is something that happened from Eisenhower's time on. But these mottos, you only have to Google them right now. You know, you'll see One Nation Under God and God We Trust are invoked by the Tea Party or invoked by members of the religious right for different ends than they've been intended.
Mm-hmm.
But once that language gets established, once you have that fusion of kind of piety and patriotism in the 1950s, it becomes a touchstone that gets used by a variety of conservative movements to this very day.
Do you see the religious right, whether or not they're aware of it, using some of the same techniques that were used in the historical period that you wrote about?
I think to some extent, yes. This general sense of an invention of a religious founding, I think it's still alive and well. That's something that the people I talk about in the book try to communicate, this constant move to recruit the founders behind this idea that America is a religious nation.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a bit of imagination, I think. I think if you look at what the founding generation said, they're quite clear on this.
Mm-hmm.
So these people, much like the religious right today, they often go back to the Declaration of Independence, the invocation of nature as God or the rights come from our creator.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to ignore the Constitution, which purposely keeps religion and the state at arm's length from one another. Mm-hmm. They ignore the Treaty of Tripoli, a treaty created by Washington, signed by Adams, ratified by a Senate that was still half full of signers of the Constitution, and ratified unanimously. And that treaty says, quote unquote, the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. Mm-hmm. So the founders were quite clear on this, but there's a desire on the part of the people I talk about in the book, and I think on the religious right today, to instead twist it so that the founders would have been strongly in favor of this, when the record, I think, suggests quite clearly, as diverse as they were, that on this issue, they were of one mind.
Kevin, what did writing the book do to you?
Oh, well, that's a good question. That's a great question. I think it made me think not just about my nation's history in a way I hadn't thought about before. It made me think about my own faith in some ways. I'm Catholic. And, you know, it's been in the decade I wrote this book, the Catholic Church has undergone some downs and, and I think recently some ups. And it's made me think about the changing nature, not just of our nation's politics, but the different faiths that that make up the nation's people. And what's going on in my own life, in my own church, and what's going on in those of others. It's given me a lot of cause to reflect.
A succinct answer on this one would be good. If there's one thing you want a reader to take away from this book, what would it be?
Our traditions are what we make of them. And so, you know, we don't need to adhere to things just because that's the way they've always been done. But I think we need to know their history, for better or worse.
Dr. Kevin Kruse is the author of the important new book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. A prolific author, Dr. Kruse is professor of history at Princeton University. He's also a member of the executive committee of the Center for the Study of Religion. And I really appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
When the United States Supreme Court made its Roe v. Wade ruling in 1973, it didn't take long for increasingly sophisticated attempts to limit women's access to reproductive care. Of all the ways this has impacted countless lives, none has been more cruel than the Helms Amendment, also passed in 1973 and frequently misused beyond its initial intent. Working to fix this is a coalition of religious and secular organizations which organized a Washington, D.C. summit this past week to move the agenda forward. And I'm delighted that this provided an opportunity for me to sit down with Reverend Harry Knox, President and CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Harry, welcome.
Thank you, Welton.
Would you give our listeners some background on the original intent of the Helms Amendment and then the way it's been applied over the years?
Well, the intent of the amendment was to prohibit funding for abortion in foreign aid, mostly through USAID, as a means of family planning. But clearly, in cases of rape and incest and life endangerment of a woman who finds herself pregnant, that's not about family planning. Mm-hmm. And in this country, where we also don't currently allow Medicaid patients to access abortion care with federal dollars, we don't make people bear the children of their rapists, and we don't make them bear the children of incest, and certainly we protect their lives. But in cases like the horrible things that we've been hearing from Boko Haram and the girls who were abducted there, and tens of them, if not hundreds of them, impregnated by their captors, that compassionate abortion care is not available to them, as it would be if the president were to interpret the Helms Amendment according to its clear language, which does allow for those kinds of exceptions.
So the president himself, if he stepped in here, could allow an interpretation of that that would permit compassionate abortions, help for these women who have been raped as an act of war.
Yes, it is a fact that it's never been done before since 1973. Both Democratic and Republican administrations have treated this like an absolute prohibition of funding for abortion, but it is within the power of the president to reinterpret that using the clear language of the law. Mm-hmm. And we are calling on him to do that because we haven't done the right thing in the past for whatever reasons doesn't mean that we can't do something good now.
Yeah.
And it really is past time for him to do it. He has all that he needs in terms of help from the advocacy organizations that have been working on this for a long time. We and our secular advocacy groups have been providing help to the administration for well over a year now about this, and it's really beyond time for them to act. So we have had to, on last Thursday, issue a very clear call as faith leaders to the president to do the moral thing in this situation, mm-hmm. and to take executive action to change this interpretation of the rule.
How much pushback are you getting from the predictable opponents to this?
Well, I think the biggest hang-up is that our opponents want exceptions for themselves when they are funded by the government to provide aid around the world. And we simply have to say that the money that is provided by the American people to serve our neighbors around the world has to be available to our neighbors regardless of the ideological bent of the providers. And if the providers don't feel like they want to provide a service that is called for in the law, then they should not be the people who are given that particular grant.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are given a grant, they shouldn't be exempted from providing that service.
Mm-hmm.
All the services that we make available, people anywhere in the world, should be made available to people everywhere in the world, mm-hmm. regardless of who the provider is.
The Washington Post, actually a week ago this weekend, did an op-ed on this very subject, and I thought it was powerfully done. Talk for a minute about what the Washington Post said about it.
They called the current policy inhumane, and it really speaks to why we as faith leaders have felt a need to speak out about this. The policy does not reflect the compassion of the American people. All of our faith traditions call on us to care for our neighbor as for ourselves. And we don't believe that barring access, creating barriers to access to compassionate abortion care for people who've been raped or who are the victims of incest or whose lives are in danger reflects the compassion that God has for them and that we as the American people have for them.
Can you tell us about the breadth of the coalition, some of the people who are in it?
It's an astonishing coalition. We had Muslims and Jews and Christians all at the summit on Thursday. Our coalition, the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, is made up of more than 20 denominations and groups in the Christian churches, the Unitarian Universalist Association, and three denominations of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very wide group of folks that went to advocate for this with the White House, and we were grateful for their support.
What's your gut level feeling about getting cooperation from the White House?
We know that the president has said that women in this terrible situation deserve compassion, and now we're calling on him to act compassionately mm-hmm. toward them. It is literally his to do. Mm-hmm. We have done our part as advocates. The American people will support him in doing it. People of faith will support him in doing it. And we're very hopeful that he will, because clearly in so many other ways he has shown himself to be a person of deep compassion. And we just are hopeful that he will do this too.
Well, Harry, I don't mind saying that I am certainly supportive of this coalition and wanting to participate in it as much as possible. And so I've been reading a good bit about this as well. And one statement I can't get out of my mind. I respect people who disagree with this. I respect people who are opposed to abortion. The fact is, I don't know many people that want abortions to happen. It's a compassionate act when that's involved. But I read the statement about the fact that some of the people opposing this action said that the violence of providing an abortion for someone raped on the battlefield would exceed the violence of war itself. I can't comprehend that.
No.
I mean, have you heard that?
Well, I have heard that, and it really shows a lack of understanding for the depth of the violence that is being experienced in some of these communities.
Yeah.
Think about the community in Nigeria to which the girls who were abducted by Boko Haram now return. That community will be filled with children who belong to no one. And that destroys the very fabric of a community.
Yeah.
And that's what rapists mean to do when they use rape as a tool of war. These terrorists have done this for a purpose.
Yeah.
And we really have to stand firmly against that. The decision to continue a pregnancy or not is always a deeply moral one. And we all know and say over and over again that that decision must be left to an individual woman in consultation with her doctor and her faith. But where, in consultation with her doctor and faith, she decides that the right thing for her to do is to end a pregnancy, where she is in the world should not decide for her whether or not she's able to access that care, particularly if she's been a victim of this sort of horrible violence.
You've talked with White House staffers. You've talked with religious leaders. When you go to talk with someone about the action that you want taken, what do you say to them?
Well, we say to them, Welton, that rape as a tool of war is as old as the scriptures. The lamentations of the people in our Judeo-Christian faith that you and I share speak to a call to God for help and redress for women who have been raped in war. And while right now we're talking about certain circumstances in certain countries, this has been done by Christians and Jews and Muslims and people of no faith at all. This knows no boundary. It knows no religious boundary. What we do know is that God's heart is sickened when it happens. And God's heart of compassion reaches out to the women who are victims of this and to the children they already have at home and to the families that they are a part of. And we must act compassionately too. And we say that to the White House, and we hear back compassionate words. Now we are calling on them to make the actions that that will really make manifest the compassion of the American people.
This is a controversial subject. It's a difficult subject even to talk about for a lot of people. Why do you do this work? You're a minister. You could go pastor a church. There are 100 other things you could do. Why are you doing what you're doing?
Well, Welton, I have pastored churches, and I have to tell you that in my own family's experience, we have faced these difficult decisions, and certainly in counseling my parishioners over the years, I have been with people who have faced all kinds of reasons why they had to consider whether or not to end a pregnancy. And my pastor's heart makes me want to make the policies of this country reflect the compassion of the American people. Because, frankly, the only thing that is standing in the way of people getting the care that they need in this country, in many cases, is money or where they live. And until we can make a just society for everyone, my work's not done.
Right.
And it has been important for me, as someone who knows some things about advocacy, to try to lead my peers, other religious leaders, in advocating for abortion access and for all kinds of women's health rights and justice.
And Harry, as I understand it, in this particular instance of dealing with the Helms Amendment, you're not asking anybody to go against their conscience. You're not asking anybody to be in full agreement with what you're doing. You are asking that as they express their opinions, their convictions according to their religion, just not to block others from pursuing compassion as they understand it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what's key. This decision should always rest with a woman herself in consultation with her physician and with her faith. And we should not block access to care of any kind, health care of any kind, based on where a person lives or what their circumstances are. And that's what we're doing when we are misinterpreting the Helms Amendment, which clearly would allow people who have been raped or the victims of incest or whose lives are in danger to get the compassionate abortion care that they need.
How can our listeners learn more about what's going on, about this specific initiative, and how can they get involved in it?
They can visit our colleagues at CHANGE's website. CHANGE stands for Center for Health and Gender Equity, and they have been our terrific secular partner in advocating for this. In fact, it was CHANGE that has raised this issue of women raped in conflict in the notice of the American people over the last couple of years in a significant way. Their website is genderhealth.org, genderhealth.org. And they can advocate through that website with the president and the White House to take action. And also, you can go to the White House's website itself and send an email if you feel strongly about this, and we would surely urge you to do that. The Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice is at rcrc.org.
The Reverend Harry Knox is president and CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. The organization's part of a campaign to limit the degree to which the Helms Amendment is applied to foreign aid programs. It's an important issue. It's an important group of people in a coalition that merits support. Harry, I want to thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for being with us today again on State of Belief Radio.
You're surely welcome. Thank you, Welton.
Those of us who remain dismayed by last year's Supreme Court ruling in Hobby Lobby, a decision that radically rewrote the rules of religious freedom in America, were anxious when the Supreme Court took up another religious freedom case this year, EEOC versus Abercrombie and Fitch Stores. The latest case concerned a young Muslim woman who was denied a job at Abercrombie and Fitch because she wore a hijab, an article of clothing that would have been in violation of Abercrombie's uniform policy. While Abercrombie suspected that she wore the headscarf for religious reasons, they claimed they were not discriminating against her because they did not explicitly know that she would need an exemption. When the Supreme Court took this case, I have to tell you, I was nervous. I was nervous that they would use this opportunity to say that the beliefs of bosses trump the beliefs of their employees. I was worried the justices might stand only for the religious majority and not religious minorities. And I have to admit, I feared they might take this opportunity to carve out a new set of policies to justify discrimination on the basis of religion. But last Monday morning, I was pleasantly surprised. The court ruled in favor of the type of narrow, reasonable exemption that would allow the plaintiff to work at Abercrombie while maintaining her religious observance. This exemption hurts no one. This exemption jeopardizes no one else's rights. It's simply about allowing a woman a small accommodation that allows her to practice her religious faith while fully participating in public life. This is what I mean when I talk about real religious freedom. Religious freedom should complement our civil rights. It shouldn't conflict with them. Religious freedom should empower people to act as equals in the public square, not sacrifice the freedom of all for the beliefs of some. Religious freedom can only be our first freedom if it brings us together in community rather than pitting us against one another. This is the vision of religious freedom that we lost in Hobby Lobby. and that we see continually degraded by attempts to pass discriminatory legislation in places like Indiana, Arkansas, and my home state of Louisiana. The religious right plays to the worst impulses of its constituency by turning religious freedom into a weapon to be used against the rights of others, to help bosses deny benefits to their employees, to justify businesses refusing service to lesbian and gay couples. Look, we've already seen the religious right claiming the Supreme Court's decision last week as a victory. They're saying that the court once again ruled for religious exemptions. They're saying that the court made it harder to limit anyone's religious expression for any reason. And they will most certainly say that if a Muslim woman is entitled to wear a hijab in her workplace, then a Christian caterer should be allowed to refuse to serve at a same-sex wedding. Folks, it's up to us to know better than that and to speak that better out loud. It's on every person of faith and those of no particular faith to see through the lies and misdirection of those who distort the First Amendment. We know that there's a version of religious freedom that respects and strengthens the rights of all, and we know that what its opponents would have us believe that the Constitution mandates is not freedom at all. The Supreme Court has highlighted that distinction with their decision in EEOC versus Abercrombie. They've shown us two types of religious freedom: the equal rights of people of all faiths they defended last week versus the discrimination promised by last year's decision in Hobby Lobby. We have the choice between these two visions, and it's up to us to make sure that a vision of equality, dignity, and respect wins the day. That's the real religious freedom. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. Look, if you find value in what you're hearing on this show, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. StateOfBelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you'll find compelling with your friends. We really need every one of you to help spread the word about State of Belief Radio. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.